That is the sound you never want to hear. It is the sound of a warning siren going off at a nuclear power plant. But whether you can hear that sound or not, we are all in the Nuclear Hot Seat. Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly podcast keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host of this podcast, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island. Today's interview is with Marius Paul and Candace Paul of the Committee for the Future Generations, a First Nations group located in northern Saskatchewan, Canada, where they are fighting against uranium mines and the proposal to locate a nuclear waste dump on their ancestral lands. A powerful, deeply moving story of ancient wisdom ignored, how the politics of poverty suit the pro-nuclear agenda, and a frontline battle to save the Earth from permanent desecration. That will be coming up in just a few minutes. Today is Tuesday, November 13, 2012, and here is the week's nuclear news. In Southern California, federal regulators have rejected a request from environmentalists to hold a court-like review of equipment issues at the long-shuttered San Onofre nuclear power plant in San Diego County. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission voted unanimously in Maryland Thursday, November 8th, to set aside the request from Friends of the Earth, but left open the possibility that a hearing might take place after further reviews. As of today, November 13, the NRC has canceled a public meeting on this issue that was to have taken place this Friday, November 16, in Southern California. We've been told that the NRC will not be influenced by Senator Barbara Boxer's office, and that we will have to take this issue to the courts. The only other thing that will help is phone calls to the NRC commissioners. Contact information for each of these people will be posted on the Nuclear Hot Seat blog page. In a related story, officials at San Onofre are investigating why coolant was found in an important piece of safety equipment during recent maintenance. They are trying to determine whether it was an accident or sabotage. Plant officials told regulators on October 30th that they discovered coolant mixed with oil that helps run an emergency diesel generator in Unit 3. They don't know right now how the coolant got in there, said John Reynoso, a Nuclear Regulatory Commission inspector at San Onofre. The failure of emergency generators at Fukushima was cited as one of several factors in that plant's meltdown last year. If the coolant had been left in place at San Onofre and the generators activated, Edison believes the governor, which controls the generator's speeds and prevents it from running too fast, would have failed. So was it an accident? Was it sabotage? Or just the usual San Onofre, Southern California Edison incompetence? Stay tuned. Superstorm Sandy appears to have shifted islands near New Jersey's Oyster Creek nuclear plant as the surge smashed through homes close by. So today, the NRC began special inspection at Oyster Creek to review issues at the site that came up during Hurricane Sandy. As water rose in the plant's water intake structure on October 29th, operators declared an unusual event at 6:55 p.m. when the water level topped 4.5 feet above mean sea level. Subsequently, at about 8:45 p.m., an alert, the second level on the NRC scale, was declared when the water level was 6 feet above mean sea level at the structure. At its greatest, the surge topped out at 7.4 feet, which is above stated protection level of 7 feet. As of now, Oyster Creek remains shut down. May it stay that way forever. There has been a fire at the Fitzpatrick Nuclear Power Plant in Oswego, New York, that shut down the plant. What's interesting is that the plant was shut down by the fire at 3:55 a.m., but not until 5:45 a.m. did the plant owners declare an unusual event to the NRC. This is the second time in a week that the Fitzpatrick Nuclear Power Plant has shut down unexpectedly. The fire was extinguished at 6:30 in the morning. Over to Japan, where the cost of cleaning up fallout from the triple meltdowns at Fukushima and compensating those whose lives have been affected may reach 10 trillion yen, according to Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO. That's the equivalent of $125.6 billion in U.S. money. Note that in the United States,
The Price-Anderson Act limits nuclear industry liability to $12 billion. So if Sandy had pushed Oyster Creek's nuclear power plant, the same model as Fukushima in Japan, if it had pushed Oyster Creek two notches up from the alert status that it did achieve, we, the taxpaying people, would be paying with our tax dollars, our chromosomes, and our genetic future. Japanese nuclear engineer Masashi Goto spoke at the Foreign Correspondents Club of Japan on November 12th. In his talk, he said, "At Fukushima, the systems that prevent nuclear contamination of the cooling water have failed, and there is direct contact between the water and the radioactive material. There are pools of some 10,000 or 20,000 tons of contaminated water in each plant at Fukushima. To bring all these to one place would mean you have to treat hundreds of thousands of tons of contaminated water, which is mind-blowing in itself. It's an outrageous amount, truly outrageous." The protests in Japan are ongoing, but it's hard to keep track of it according to their major media. The Mainichi newspaper first ran a story about the recent protest in Japan that had 100,000 people showing up. Indeed, the title read, 100,000 Protest Against Nuclear Power in Central Tokyo. However, in their next edition, they changed their headline to, Thousands Protest Against Nuclear Power in Central Tokyo. According to figures released by demonstration organizer Metropolitan Coalition Against Nukes, the 100,000 figure does hold. At one point, there were so many protesters packed into one place, they disrupted use of local crosswalks. But police put that figure at about 7,000, which leads one to believe that they are math-challenged. A demonstration scheduled for the capital's Hibiya Park the same day was canceled after the Tokyo Metropolitan Government refused to issue a permit. On to radiation concerns in Japan. The government of Japan is worried about highly radioactive fish. Persistently high radioactivity in some fish caught close to the Fukushima nuclear power plant has sparked a government investigation into the physiological basis for contamination and why radiation readings in some specimens remain hundreds of times over the official safe limit. Maybe it's because they're swimming through water that is highly contaminated with radiation. In August, two greenlings caught 20 kilometers north of the Fukushima plant were found to have cesium levels of 25,800 becquerels per kilogram, the highest level ever measured in fish since the nuclear accident. The government standard for food is 100 becquerels per kilogram. Not that that level is safe, it's just that's the level that the government has arbitrarily set. In March, tests recorded a level of 18,700 becquerels per kilogram in freshwater salmon caught in the Nitagawa River near Itate. Cesium in freshwater salmon and char caught since March has not been decreasing, leading to restrictions on shipment. So if you're dying for sushi, you may be dying from sushi. So if a food has touched the Pacific Ocean, do not put it in your mouth. Here's the Nuclear Numbnuts of the Week award. Fukushima Prefecture will start exporting apples grown in the prefecture to Thailand starting later this month. Why Thailand? Because unlike China, Hong Kong, Korea, Macau, Taiwan, Singapore, or Brunei, which still ban the import of Fukushima produce, Thailand only requires certificates of radiation testing. In the same category as Thailand are Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Guess where those apples are going to be showing up next? The official monitoring test in Fukushima shows apples with radioactive cesium have been harvested this year. Note that according to Physicians for Social Responsibility, there is no safe level of exposure to radiation. None. Zero. Zip. So if you find yourself in Thailand, stay away from the apples. Russia has more common sense than even the United States. They have been testing goods brought to them from Japan, and according to the Russian news agency, Prima Media, from January to September in this year, the radiation dose in excess of Russian standards was detected in 319 separate goods, such as used cars, food, medical supplies, and other objects which were imported from Japan. In 2011, 145 separate goods were sent back to Japan due to the radiation dose in excess of standard Russian values. Russia expects the number of cases to reach almost double the 2011 levels. Meanwhile, in the United States, we are not even testing anything that comes from Japan for potential radiation. According to Reuters, Britain's nuclear push may stall as risks mount. A utilities analyst at London-based investment bank Liberum Capital, Dominic Nash, is quoted as saying, "To put money into UK nuclear would be crazy." Energy Fair, a research group of energy economists opposed to nuclear, said in a report last month that the true cost of nuclear could be over £200 per megawatt, meaning $317 in American money, once the hidden subsidies are taken into account. And in Canada, radionuclides and trace metals have been found in Canadian moose near uranium mines. Tissues from 45 moose and 4 cattle were collected to assess the health of country foods near uranium mines in northern Saskatchewan. Bone, liver, kidney, muscle, and rumen contents, stomach contents, were analyzed. Moose from this area had significantly higher levels of radium, radioactive lead, polonium, and cesium-137 in some edible soft tissues. That makes a perfect lead-in to this week's interview. Social media has introduced me to a wide range of activists I might never have met any other way. I've been intrigued in particular by the Facebook posts of Marius Paul, a First Nations activist from northern Saskatchewan in Canada. He's reported on his group's march across the province to bring awareness of the health problems caused by the area's uranium mines and the radiation that's been released into their lives. Now the battle is heating up with word that Canada is seeking to build a nuclear waste depository not far from where he lives. Marius and his co-activist and wife Candace provide one of the most genuinely moving interviews I've ever conducted for Nuclear Hot Seat, ranging from his culture's ancient warnings against touching uranium ore to the nuclear industry's shameless manipulation of children, the government, and universities to get what they want. Marius Paul is Dinesukline of the Poplar Tree Home People from the northern portion of present-day Saskatchewan. This is a region in which his people have made their home for thousands of years. Working with his wife, Candace, they have created a school in their home community that services more than 100 students in grades 4 through 12. It operates from a third world setting, focusing on throwing off the mantles of colonization to which his people have been conditioned. Marius has worked against uranium mining setting up on lands of his people since the early 1970s, with groups that include the Interchurch Group on Uranium, Clean Green, Kairos, and RPIC, which stands for Renewable Power and Intelligent Choice. Candace has been an active member of the Committee for Future Generations in their campaign to raise awareness of the real risks of the nuclear waste dump being proposed in northern Saskatchewan. Marius and Candace Paul, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
I'm very, very pleased to be here with you.
Hi.
It's great to have both of you here with me. There is an ancient tribal wisdom in your people about what is called the Black Stone and how the people were supposed to deal with it. Can you explain that story and how it relates to uranium?
We're transliterating from the Dene Sukine language and tongue to the English language. Ancient stories about the Black Stone, Tezanedic, she called it, and I had remembered it from way, way back. My grandfather, who lived up in the northern areas of Saskatchewan during the fur trade era, 1800 up into the 1900s. He was quite old when he passed on. But he always forbade everybody to not touch those black stones. He did mention that when they were underground, they served like a little stove, he called it. They were very, very warm. It was a very controlled type of heating underground, which continuously was providing some kind of heat.
And this is the, what is it called, pitch blend or pitch stone?
I think so. Scientists that I've been communicating with have also indicated that they were possibly pitch blend. And before they appeared on the surface, they were white in color. They were underneath the ground. And that's why my grandfather always pointed that out. They were very, very pure in color, and then when it was exposed out in the open, it turned quite dark. He always forbade those people, everyone, to not touch those things.
And those stones, indeed, were the ones that contained uranium.
Yes, they were uranium. To us, it was more than that. It was literally a deity, like God, or something that had a type of a sacred connection to us. So it was in that sense that we understood the black stone. Like water, it was the same thing, or a plant. My grandfather that worked as a herbalist also forbade us to talk about plants like you would ordinarily talk about anything. He said to never, ever mention a plant as a plant. It was a deity. It was powerful. So in that type of worldview, we learned to accept the conditions of the natural world that way. And I believe that even Albert Einstein also said that his theory of relativity would have been understood much better by the indigenous languages, which I think is the proper way that he gave us great kudos for understanding a language that he was developing through the math, through the physics.
With the tribal people already being told to avoid the black stone, which indeed contains uranium, how did uranium mining come to the native lands in Saskatchewan, and how did it get beyond people's being told not to have anything to do with that stone?
I believe the mining company started moving in as soon as it was found out that it carried properties that could be exploited. After the scientific community found out that it had peculiar properties and a uniqueness that they could understand. In terms of the studies that was being done from the 30s on, in Saskatchewan, approximately the late 1940s and into the 50s, it was starting to get to be known that the Canadian Shield country that we live on, or we lived on, provided the uranium ore deposits. And during all those periods of time, we would often run into lone prospectors that were also roaming the land at the same time as we were. Because when I was a kid, we lived on the land and we did pretty well what our ancestors had been doing for the past many, many thousands of years. But we did run into these prospectors and they were busy checking out the land formations, the rock formations. And
specifically, they were looking for uranium.
I think they were looking for all kinds of minerals, including uranium.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, I understand that there were 12 uranium mines created in northern Saskatchewan, which, of course, created tremendous quantities of waste and tailings, which made the areas highly radioactive. First of all, how was it that the native people went along with or were tricked into going along with the idea of creating these mines?
There was a very crude business plan where there was a kind of a collusion between the companies that were interested in exploiting the lands and the elected people called the government. I think that they had a program of keeping the native communities poor. So when the time did come, they would have to circumvent what they call treaty law. That's the number of treaties were signed between two nations, in this case between the Crown of England and the First Nation people that they were conducting agreements with. So in order to circumvent that, they had to try to find a way to ensure that when the appropriate time came, they would have a little carrot dangling in front of them so that the First Nation people would agree to the terms of the companies. So when they did started that process many, many years ago, it was always a given that the First Nation communities would have no choice but to adapt, to accept, and then adapt what they've always known were a bunch of big lies that were happening. They always understood that the lands that they lived on were very productive, and since they had survived on it for thousands of years, they knew that it could also afford the same type of rich historical development for the next group of people. But there again, there was a difference in opinion of how the environment should have been regarded, just the same way as what I mentioned when my grandfather said, do not look at these items, such as rocks, water, as rocks or water. They were deities. It was still the same. How could we convince the mining companies that were coming in, the uranium that you are touching should not be used in any way? Otherwise, it would go into another annal of legends, which described a very dire situation that once this has been touched that way, it would unleash the demons. And with the fissioning of products and the introduction of man-made materials that are extremely poisonous, we are trying to make a connection to that, that the industrial components of nuclear cannot be redacted by images of atomic explosions, etc., as well as the lethal effects of radiation on health.
It's fascinating that you come from a tribal tradition that in essence seems to have warned us about the dangers of nuclear, though not in a way that anyone from the Western world took seriously. I'm wondering if there's any documentation on the impact that these 12 uranium mines have had on people, on their health, on their well-being, anything that can be documented about how people have been negatively impacted by the radiation.
The waste and tailings in these are highly radioactive. And what we have found in our communities is that our health is being impacted. We are seeing a much higher cancer rate and more birth defects and more people having autoimmune deficiency diseases, which are all and can all be related back to radiation exposures. The main thing up here is from the milling and processing and tailings. And the miners bring home dust on themselves as well. I mean, it's hard to avoid. And these things are in open pits. Every time they do an explosion on some of the open pit mines, the radioactivity is recordable in Winnipeg, Manitoba, 48 hours later. So we know that it's being spread all over the environment up here. And what people, the elders have noted especially, and the land users have noted, is there's getting to be much fewer animals, birds, insects, fish are sick or got tumors. There's reports of two-headed, one-eyed rabbit. It's within our food chain, and because people up here still eat a lot of wild foods and gather a lot of berries, and that's a mainstay of our diets up here. What we found is that they have done studies that they never made public. They're in the internet, but a lot of people who are out on the land don't go about using the internet. And they have studied the moose and the caribou, and studies showed that they do have trace elements of heavy metals and radionuclides.
That was a story that we reported earlier on this exact same podcast about what was found in the moose in your area.
Right.
Now, these mines are still active?
These mines are all still active. There are some mines that have shut down, like the Gunner Mine, the El Dorado Mine, the Uranium City Mine. But the tailings from these mines are still floating everywhere. They're in ponds and mounds all over the north. There's been lots of different accidents where these ponds have the tailings is made into a pasty stuff, like mixed with water, so it's like the consistency of about toothpaste. And over 1 million gallons have broken through the tailing ponds at different times. And these are open to the elements, so like when it rains and so forth. I mean,
so it's broken through to the groundwater and the aquifers.
It's gotten through to the aquifers, yes.
It's devastating to hear how even before it gets to a nuclear reactor or a nuclear bomb, just the mining of the raw materials puts people at such great risk.
they do put people at great risk, but they claim that it doesn't really. There's no, they never did a baseline study.
That's what they always do. They fail to get the statistics so that they have reasonable deniability.
Right. And when they say that there's no significant risk, it implies that there is a risk. It's not significant to them. It is to those who are suffering from the cancers and the illnesses. We figure we lose about 4 people a month in the north from cancers. And like in a population in our reserve of 750 approximately people.
That's enormous.
There's 550, over 50 that are suffering from cancer at the moment. And that doesn't take into consideration people born with no hand, people born with their intestinal cavities open. It doesn't take into consideration the increase in the rates of things like lupus and those kinds of things, which are also apparent up here as well.
I understand that there are plans afoot to develop a long-term waste storage facility in northern Saskatchewan. Talk to me about your understanding of this plan, how it was discovered, and what the people are doing to fight back against it.
First time I heard about the plan was when something came to our classroom called Classroom News, and in it was an article that said,
this is a newspaper?
It is a current event resource for teachers to use to teach current events, and in this one was a news item that said English River First Nation, which is where we live, Pinehouse Lake, and another town called Creighton were all in the adaptive phase management looking at nuclear waste storage with the Nuclear Waste Management Organization. This was the first time I'd heard about it. So other people in our community heard about it when they went to an elders conference that was put up by the community of Pinehouse to address suicide rates.
About how long ago was this?
This was in the spring of 2011. They were sitting there in an elder circle discussing suicide prevention, and all of a sudden they came to a part where it says NWMO and duty to consult as being the answer to suicides. So they were blaming suicides on low economic rates, and they thought that if they could bring in tons of money, that would be the answer to preventing suicides.
So in other words, the bait is always the community is poor, the people are poor and disempowered. Let's give them opportunities to make more money by doing something that's more dangerous than you're being informed is the danger.
And since then, they have engaged like Pinehouse and English River in this process. They've had a few open houses in the communities, but they've been like into the community behind closed doors many times. I asked directly at one open house after the lady had shown me the whole system of storage system and gone on about how safe it was. I asked her, if this is so safe and you have the same rock formations in northern Ontario as you do here, why you would bother going through the trouble and the expense and the risk of transporting it here. And she said, the people of Toronto don't feel safe. So I said, in other words, you're saying that because there's only 35,000 people here in northern Saskatchewan, it's worth it to you that we take the risk rather than you. You would make us expendable, which she sputtered over and didn't really respond. But she lives in Toronto.
What's ironic is that news has broken that there is a facility in Toronto, in the city, that has been making, I believe it's nuclear pellets for fuel rods for several decades. And this is a story so big that even the mainstream media is covering it. Are you familiar with that one?
Yes, I am. We actually had heard that there was a facility like that before the news came out. I mean, there had to be one somewhere, right? That facility was in a warehouse district, but most factories and so forth were sold and taken down, and it's become a residential area. But since it's become a residential area, no one in the area really knew what the building was doing, like what activity goes on in that building.
Was there any kind of a containment structure or a barrier other than a shell building there?
It's a building with a chain-link fence around it.
That's not going to stop much radiation.
No. They say it's a medium-risk facility. So, yes, before the pellets go into the nuclear reactor. They're not anywhere near as radioactive as they would be once they've been through it. After they've been through it, they're a billion times, and I'm not exaggerating, they're a billion times more radioactive. However, I mean, they would be just as radioactive as the tailings, et cetera, here. So, I mean, if we're getting sick from this distance, they should be worried.
And they should be aware, the realtors need to be aware, and the people in the neighborhoods need to be aware of the risk that they are facing simply by living in what they think is a nice home.
Yes, and, you know, where was the city zoning in this? Like, they just obviously dropped the ball on this one. The company claimed that they had gone through the public and let them know, you know, what they're doing when they went for relicensing or something. And the public said, oh, really? I never heard about it. Nobody had. So, like, they made a claim which was false. And that's what raised the alarm bells within the community.
Obviously, these are ongoing situations, both of them, and especially dire in your community, considering you've been subject to this for so long. I understand that longtime anti-nuclear activist Dr. Helen Caldicott recently visited in northern Saskatchewan to take a look and learn more about the problems there. Do you know what brought her up there, and what was her visit like to be experienced by all of you?
I was actually part of the planning committee that brought her in, along with another group other than the Committee for Future Generations. And she offered to come in and help us raise awareness, because once she heard about what was happening here regarding the nuclear waste and the government still wanting to build nuclear reactors here, even though people had been saying for many times over, no, we don't want nuclear reactors in Saskatchewan. And the fact that the government now is insisting that, you know, we should be building nuclear reactors to fuel the tar sands extraction. The other thing is GE Hitachi also just signed and gave over a bunch of money to the University of Saskatchewan, which was matched by the government of Saskatchewan, to develop the Canadian Centre for Nuclear Innovation.
Oh, no.
Where they will research small reactor development. They say they're going to, like, they tuck that in amongst, you know, radioisotopes and stuff, which even on the University of Saskatchewan doesn't have to happen, because we already have a synchrotron, which is a better and much more safer method of developing radioisotopes. It's taken over the university. There's a big conflict of interest between the Board of Governors. People from Cameco sit on the Board of Governors, and they've pretty much taken over the entire aspect of the university. When we were part of a group that raised awareness by walking from Pinehouse Lake to the legislative buildings in Regina. It's an 850-kilometer walk in 2011. We were not allowed to walk on the university. We could not get permission. We needed $1 million liability insurance to walk on the university. So, you know, the blocks were up.
Have you had any coverage in the media in Canada? Is it any better up there than it is down here?
When we did the walk, we had some decent coverage for a while. About partway through the walk, between Saskatoon and Regina, the president of the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, Ken Nash, went to the newspapers, and editorial was written. And in that editorial, he said it would be unconscionable for us to pass up this unparalleled economic opportunity and not take the risks and test the science.
I wonder what he'd say if it was his own children. What is it that your group is going to be doing? Obviously, this is a long-term battle that you are in, as we all are. What are the next steps in front of you that you plan on taking?
We are still in the process of making sure that people in northern Saskatchewan, particularly, just to address a little bit more on the last question, media kind of cut it right after that. We've had difficulty even within local media. They're afraid to print anything from us because it might cut government funding to their radio stations or their so forth. So what we have been doing is a northern campaign of raising awareness and getting people to get to know more about it. There's a horrible feeling within the communities that the government's going to push this through just like they push through uranium mining. Our biggest challenge is to make sure that people realize that they can still do something about it. It's not set in stone. It is, they do say that they will leave if a willing host community is, you know, the community that they choose is not showing enough willingness. However, they've left it to the community to decide what willing means. So that's kind of an iffy situation. We're also working on raising awareness about what the whole uranium mining thing is, because the remaining mining companies, Cameco is one of the ones that is one of the biggest ones in here, Cameco and Areva, are part owners of the nuclear power generators in the east. So they have a lot to lose if this doesn't go through. There is also great concern that the government will eventually, because of NAFTA, allow nuclear waste from the United States to come in. And we know there's a hell of a big pile of it down there.
We've got over 75,000 tons, no place to put it, and I don't know that that includes everything that's been generated since they came up with that number.
No, and everything that'll be sitting in pools for the next...
For as long as any of us can conceive.
Yes, from a piece of research I just went through, they're going to need hundreds of these repositories if that's the method they use worldwide. It's getting people to know what the risks are. Don't really trust what they're trying to tell you, because they're not telling you about the health risks. They're not telling you a lot of anything. When they go to our communities, they use glossy written poster boards all over the room and fancy little models, and they hand out little replica keychains of spent fuel rods. They go into our schools, they take our students out and tell them about all the jobs. Native Women's Association of Canada had actually been given some funding from Nuclear Waste Management Organization to become educated on this issue. Through some of our contacts, we found out there's really only in the end about 11 to 17 jobs. There is going to be infrastructure jobs during the whole process of building the thing, but once it's built, there's not even going to be security jobs, because they're going to bring in paramilitary security to secure these kinds of sites. They call it adaptive phase management, this plan that they have. And the reason it's called that is because they keep changing it. At one point, they said, you know, we only need this much land, and, you know, we need this much on the surface, and we need this much underground. But if you keep digging and you keep digging in farther and farther into their information, you find that they need a large surrounding area.
And they're only going to talk about the small amount so that they can get the toehold, and then once they get started, it's like, well, we need more, we need more, we need more. We've spent so much already, we can't possibly back down from this, because then we would lose our investment and it would be bad for the blah, 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 blah. And
they're
just spinning it until everybody's dizzy and they get exactly what they want.
Exactly. The other thing that we're really concerned about is they only plan on being around between 60 and 100 years. After that, we're stuck with it.
Yeah.
Another thing that's deeply embedded in their information is the reprocessing. They reprocess up here and our aquifers are done. Reprocessing involves boiling the spent fuel rods in nitric acid to get out the plutonium. And then you've got effluents to the air, and you've got effluents to the aquifers, and you've got radioactive acid to contain. But they're only sticking around 100 years.
Yeah, so basically you're facing the ancestral lands, which have supported your people for so long, turning into a dead zone.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, this is a horrific story, yet another part of how, to use the term evil, the nuclear industry is and has been. What I'd like to know now is if you could receive support from other concerned citizens in Canada, the United States, or any place within the sound of this podcast, what would you like that support to look like?
I'd like the support to be, they spend millions and millions of dollars pushing their agenda. They're on a huge, huge PR campaign. We do things like yard sales to raise funds to put up a camp to bring in speakers that can enlighten and teach our people. We don't have access to that kind of comparative education. We would like people who are able to come up and share their expertise with us to please do so, just as Dr. Helen Caldicott did. It means a lot that we can bring these to our people, because our people are more comfortable learning in their own environment, and we don't have the funds to take the people out to teach them. So this is an important aspect of it. Anybody who can help debunk the ideas, great, come and join on. We have a petition going within Saskatchewan to our government, which we turned in over 12,000 signatures, and we have several thousand more, which the government has ignored. Anything that people can do to assist us. At some point, you know, when push comes to shove, I don't think we're willing to let them in. We're not going to back up and just take the jobs. If people could be here to be with us when that time comes, if it comes to that, that would be a great help too.
Thank you to both Marius and Candace Paul from Saskatchewan, and me, we, and all the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat wish you every success in your campaign to stop this nuclear contamination of your native lands and turn around the campaign that is launched against you to create even more nuclear horrors up in that part of the world. We wish you every success.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
To contact Marius and Candace Paul and learn what you can do to help their cause, go to their website, which is committeeforfuturegenerations.wordpress.com. You can email them at committeeforfuturegenerations@gmail.com. And please sign up for their Facebook pages, which are First Nations Say No to Nuclear and Say No to Nuclear Waste Storage in Northern Saskatchewan. Here's the week's final thought. It was hard for me to edit this week's interview because I found the material shared by Marius and Candace Paul to be so deeply moving. Listening to the litany of horrors heaped upon people who still live off the land, learning of their cancer rate in proportion to their population, knowing that the universities have been bought off and media scared off the story, it was painful enough to listen to it once, let alone the number of times I hear it during the editing process. Even worse, these people come from a culture that has traditionally warned of the danger of human hands touching the black stone, pitch blend, which is the source of uranium. Tribal lore going back thousands of years warned that touching the black stone would unleash demons. And using that as a metaphor for the horrors of unending nuclear radiation contamination, it seems their ancient wise ones were right. What we didn't cover in the interview is the aspect of ongoing racial genocide against the First Nations people, and how nuclear is the latest means of getting rid of tribal people who come from, venerate, and live with the land. What's the difference between the balls-out, arrogant manipulations of nuclear industrialists and the Nazis, who similarly didn't care who they wiped out to get what they wanted? Indeed, these nuclear Nazis show no concern for human life, planetary sanctity, or, it seems, anything beyond their own bank accounts. They are psychotic, completely divorced from humanity, having no empathy. There is nothing halfway about nuclear. It has unleashed the demons. It makes Pandora's box look like a sandbox. Something has to change before it truly is too late. Either we find ways to turn this around, or we are doomed and life on Earth with us. Remember that old slogan? Better active today than radioactive tomorrow? Time is running out. Let's all get active now, while we still can. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, November 13, 2012. Material for this podcast has been gathered from ENENews.com, Reuters, the Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook Network, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Japan Times, Mainichi, Asahi, NHK, and nuclearnews.net. You can find each of our episodes posted on nuclearhotseat.com/blog, on the Facebook Nuclear Hot Seat pages, and on iTunes podcasts, where you can subscribe for free. share us, link to us, forward the links to others. We've got to get out of the echo chamber, folks. We've got to talk to people besides just ourselves. So why don't you link to this and forward it to at least two people you know who aren't yet part of our community but just might be encouraged to join us. And if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send me an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, don't go back to sleep.